taking of this precious Sunday morning to join us. And we thank you so much for stepping out to share your wisdom and insight with all of us. We're going to hear this morning about a very important and relevant issue. And I can tell you it's something that comes up here all the time. Costco every so often sells things that people are not sure about. So I'm sure Rabbi Rabinowitz will give us great insight and hadracha and how to deal with these kinds of issues. So without further ado.
If you don't mind, I'm going to sit down so I'm out of your line sight to the screen. Firstly, thank you, Rabbi Schechter, for this opportunity. It's really a pleasure to come and speak, especially as we just completed Shabbos Nachmo. I think last week our focus was on the past, Churban of Yerushalayim, and Shabbos Nachmo, we're sort of looking to the future. We're looking to, and obviously part of that future, and a significant part of that future, are coming to Israel and participating in all the wonderful mitzvahs that are relevant for those that are in Israel. But as we'll see, it's maybe not just those who are in Israel, but occasionally we have that opportunity even as we sit here in the exile. Now, just yesterday we read Parshas Veschanan, and Parshas Veschanan opens with Moshe Rabbeinu looking across the Yarden and looking at the Eretz Yisrael, and Chazal say, there's a Gemara in Sotah that says that why did Moshe so much, in fact, Chazal say that he davened 515 tefillos, Veschanan is Gematria 515, why did he so much want to go into Israel? So Rav Samloi says, because, not because he just wanted to eat the fruits, delicious fruit in Israel, but not just because he wanted to satisfy himself with all the bounty of Israel. Rather, there are so many beautiful mitzvahs that are related to the produce of Israel, and that's what he was interested in. That opportunity to fulfill the mitzvahs, the beautiful mitzvahs of Israel, is something that we here don't have that much opportunity, but occasionally we do have, and certainly when we travel to Israel, we certainly have that opportunity. You know, much of in Kashrus, I'm working in the OU for about 25 years now. Much of what was related to, you know, everyone, lay people, has been removed from our. You ask a child today, where do you get chicken? You go to the store, the grocery shop. What are the steps, you know, the shechit, the malicha, and so on, that are involved in preparing a kosher chicken? And the same is true of our experience with agriculture is very limited, because we go to store shelves. We don't, but the reality is that it's very much part and parcel of what it means to be a Jew, and there are many Jews in Israel who are fulfilling that on a regular basis. So we'll start with just the opening concept. What is tevel? Tevel means something which has not been separated. And that is defined, as the Rambam says, whenever you have produce which is required to have separations from it. So you have something which you must take off the various separations and give to the various individuals who are the recipients of those separations. So until that is achieved, so we have a problem. Because what you're taking something which ultimately has the potential for Kedusha, because there's sanctity involved in these separations and in the way some of them are consumed. And you have this potential Kedusha, and if you don't fulfill it, you don't bring it to the fore, so then there's a pasuk that says, "V'lo yichallu es kodshei b'nei Yisrael," do not desecrate the kodshei b'nei Yisrael, the sanctified items of b'nei Yisrael, asherimu l'Hashem, that are supposed to be given. Yorimu is a lashon of separation, also of uplifting, which is what we do when we separate. And it's actually rather severe. If a person consumes tevel, there's a chiyuv misa. It's actually a capital punishment for a person, at least v'dei shamayim, and not a court, a mortal court would not judge somebody for misa, but it's actually a heavenly death which befalls a person who does not make these separations and would consume the product as is, or the produce as is. Now, I want to introduce another concept, is what is arla and what is revai? Arla, when a person plants trees, it's specifically trees, it doesn't apply to vegetables, but in this case you see a picture of you know, people planting a vineyard. And if a person plants a vineyard or any other tree, an apple tree, a peach tree, so what happens is, Pasuk tells us, you come to the land of Israel, you will plant trees, and what you need to do is for 3 years, you cannot touch that. It's forbidden to consume any fruit that would result from that planting. It's even forbidden to benefit in any way from that fruit. What happens in the fourth year is that in the fourth year, you can partake of it, but only under very special conditions. Which means that a person would have to, it's kodesh, it's considered sanctified, and you couldn't just take it, pick it, and consume it. You would have to take it up to Jerusalem, and you could only consume it under special conditions in Yerushalayim. That's the mitzvah of Revai. So Arla is the first 3 years when it's forbidden, and incidentally, just the, you know, many people have the minute to do an upshare. That's a young child, for the first 3 years, don't cut the hair, and only after 3 years. So many say that it's based on this, because a person at a certain level is like a tree. Elder Meitz HaSadeh, right? So therefore, what happens is, we don't want to touch it for 3 years, we want to leave, and only after that point, so that's the minik. Some say the basis is this mitzvah of Arla. Now, what's relevant for us here in Chutz Laaretz, and actually it's something which I've had a couple of episodes happen, there's a din in Shulchan Aruch that says that when there's a question of Arla, we don't know, not always can we identify if a fruit is Arla or not Arla. Sometimes we're you know, ignorant to that. So if it's a question, in Israel, it's forbidden. In Chutz Laaretz, in the diaspora, it is permitted, which is actually very... In Israel, when people go to buy produce, local produce, they have to know that it's not Arla. Here, they don't ask questions. If you know something is Arla, if you're a farmer, and you have your own fruit tree or whatever it is, and you planted it yourself, and you know certainly that it's Arla, so then, obviously, you can't partake of it, even in Chutz Laaretz. But if you don't know, I don't have to question. So that's a very important distinction between the two. And just one other is I guess today, it's not as common to take seeds and plant trees. Today, what they're doing often is what's called grafting. Now, that's called harkava. Now, grafting is something which is for, meaning, in Israel, if someone were to graft, whether a vineyard or whether a tree, what happens is, you start the clock again. For 3 years, you can't partake from that fruit. But in Chutz Laaretz, it's not like that. So that's a very important distinction. And that's why, for the most part, Arla, Revai, is off our radar. Because it's just, do I know? We don't know about it. We don't have to ask questions. But in Israel, it's very much on the radar. And that's why when people buy produce in Israel, which has a proper hashkacha on it, that is one of the things that they're very careful about. There are actually mashgichim and rabbis who go out to the fields, and they're monitoring what happens in the fields. Yes, they're going to monitor some of the other discussions we're going to have about truma and meiser, but they're also monitoring that it's not from the first 3 years, or if it is, from the fourth year, it's something that we need to address, and we'll talk about that. Continuing on, let's give a little history. History lesson. Okay, so when Yoshua brought the Jews to Israel, they were called, for the purposes of this conversation, they were called Olei Mitzrayim. They were those who came up, went up to Israel from the land of Egypt. So the Olei Mitzrayim came to Israel, and they conquered a rather significant piece of land for Israel. And that's approximately, and again, there are a lot of disputes, details. Now, we're familiar with the map, for the most part, I think. And if you take a look at this, what's included here, it actually does not descend all the way down to, you know, the Negev, this, what's called the Negev Hadorim, the southern Negev. So that, halachically, is not considered the land of Israel. But it does include, it goes down to, essentially, the bottom of Yam HaMelech, of the Dead Sea, and then it sort of takes a turn and crosses over. Incidentally, it does not include the land of Plishtim, which is, for all intents and purposes, Gaza. So that's also excluded, but we'll talk about that a little bit later. It includes a very significant portion of what's called today Transjordan, because Eiver HaYarden was settled by the 2.5 tribes that remained on the other side of the Jordan. So this was a rather significant area, which was the land of Israel at the time of the conquering, when Yeshua conquered the land in those 7 years. However, when Ezra, after Galus Bavel, when he returned afterwards, they didn't actually conquer, because it was something which was given to them. The Persian monarchs allowed them to come in and take over the land. So it wasn't called as if kibush, which means conquering. It was called machzik, which means they took land and they established a country, and they established the Beis HaMikdash in that country. But it was actually much smaller. It did not include Eiver HaYarden. Transjordan was not included. There are certain, what's called the Galil HaTzafon, which means the northern Galil, was also not included. And similar to that, the southern area was also not included. So it was a smaller country. Now, what Chazal tell us, the Rambam here mentions this, but what Chazal tell us is this. When they conquered the land, that Kedusha, that sanctity that was established, that lasted only so long as they were in the country. But when they were driven out of the country by Nebuchadnezzar, by the Babylonians, that Kedusha ceased. And that's not to say the Kedusha ceased completely. The Beis HaMikdash was the Beis HaMikdash, the Har HaBayis was the Har HaBayis. That Kedusha remained. But in terms of these halachas of Truma and Meiser and all these different halachas, so what happened is that ceased. Finished. There was no more, these halachas did no longer apply. When Ezra came back and he took over the smaller, so that created once again a Kedusha, but that created a Kedusha only for that section. It did not go so far. So for example, if you have fruits, vegetables that are coming from Transjordan, which there is some, there is actually some Israeli farmers who go and are involved in agriculture in Jordan. And it's relevant especially for Shemitah during the seventh year, when there are all kinds of complicated issues which we're not going to get into today. There is a significant of produce which is coming across the Jordan. Now, because it's a smaller, that's what we need to be concerned about for Truma, for Meiser, for Arlo, for Havai, really only applies to the smaller. Now there's another factor which is important, and the Shulchan Aruch says that from the biblical law, from Torah, the only time that there's a biblical law to take off the separations is only when all of the Jewish people live in Israel. Is that the case today? No. So what happens is, when we don't have, now when we say all of the Jewish people, we don't mean literally all of the Jewish people. That wouldn't mean that when the Jews lived in Israel and one person took a trip, then all of a sudden the halachas disappear. What it means is at least the majority. We have a general rule, rubo kekula. We say, if there's a majority, it's like the whole people out there. So when you have a majority of the people living in the land, so then we say that there's a biblical law to take off truma and maaser. If, however, you don't have a majority, so then it's only a rabbinic law. It's only the rabbanon. It's not a d'oraisa. It's not a biblical law. So just for if we're interested in knowing, according to Wikipedia, which is of course the source of repute, is the Jewish population of the world today is a little bit over 14 million people. That's Wikipedia. I don't take responsibility for that. I mean, the truth is these figures are so hard to figure out anyway. And the criteria that go into what determines who is a Jew is not necessarily a halacha criteria either. So that's an important factor. But it's just an interesting trivia is that if you look at the USA Jewish population, we have 5.3 million Jews, at least according to Wikipedia, in the United States today, which is 38% of the world's Jewish population. So that's just an interesting trivia. And as we unfortunately know, it's going down. And it keeps going down. And I don't even know if it's 5.3. My suspicions are that it may even be less than that. But of course, some of the, you know, the observant community, the Orthodox community, keeps growing. And unfortunately, the other sections of the Jewish people, you know, are unfortunately just sort of disappearing in front of our eyes. It's very unfortunate. Now, if we take a look at the rest of the world, so the next 10 countries, in terms of size, you know, France, which is also slowly depleting, they've lost, I think, about almost a third of the population over the last 5 years, most of which have fortunately gone to Israel. But it's probably under 500,000, and probably it keeps going down. And, you know, Canada, Britain, and Russia. Russia is a fraction of what it used to be. Russia apparently had, in Soviet times, over 1 million Jews. But what happened is, number one, you know, intermarriage, and number two, you know, the mass exodus to Israel, or to other countries. Today, Germany has about 100,000 Jews, mostly from the former Soviet Union. So, and you know, even if you, beyond this is, you know, the rest, if you take a look at the whole rest of the world, you have about 70% of the Jewish population, about close to 2.5 million Jews elsewhere, which leaves us with Israel. Israel has, today, it keeps growing, has about 6.4 million Jews. I mean, the population is actually larger, but the Jewish population, about 6.4 million, so 46% of the Jewish people live in Israel today, assuming Wikipedia is accurate. And as we know, it keeps going up, it keeps growing. Because, firstly, because there's, you know, large families there, in many sectors, and there's also immigration to Israel. So some estimate that over the next maybe 20 years, it's very likely that the Jewish, you know, based on current trends, that over the next 20 years, the majority of the Jewish people will be in Israel. I mean, I hope that it's not going to wait that long. It's going to go much faster than that. But many argue that. But that has actually halachic ramifications, because what is today Truma Maisa, our only rabbinic, would become Daraisa, it would become the Torah laws if that were to take place. And it's most relevant, I guess, for Shemitah could also change. That's a little bit more complicated, but it's just an interesting trivia about the direction that we're heading in. So, what about not all the land in Israel is farmed by Jews? There is land. What happens if you have Paris on? You have non-Jews who farm land, and they have produce. So the halacha is that, for example, you know, sometimes more primitive, less primitive, that the halacha is that there is no truma meiser from there if they both farm the land and finish the, meaning they actually bring in harvest and finish the processing of the fruits. Those are exempt from truma meiser. That's the halacha. Now, one might think, you know, many, for example, in Israel today, the workers are not necessarily Jewish. There are many who hire non-Jewish workers, and, you know, they would bring in non-Jewish workers. The fact that you bring in a non-Jewish worker does not exempt it. If the land is owned by Jews, so here Shimon Peres brought in his counterpart to do some farming, that would not exempt that tree from the halachas of Truma and Maaser. Now, where do we derive all the halacha of Truma and Maaser? It's based on a pasuk. Pasuk says, Reishis degancha, your grains, tiroshcha, which means your oils, I'm sorry, tiroshcha is your wine, and v'yitzarecha is your oils, and also Reishis geitzoncha, which refers to the sheep, the shearings of the sheep, the wool, Titin lo, you're supposed to give to whom? To the Kohen. And we learn out from Truma to Maaser all the other halachas. So, biblically, it applies really only to grain. Now, when we define grain, what are we talking about? We're talking about the five types of grain that there are, which is really only barley, rye, oats, wheat, and spelt. It's just its browse, if you want it just as an acronym to remember them. Those are what we make hamotzi on. If they're made into bread, that's what we make hamazonos on. If they're made into pasavavikistin, which are the semi-breads that we have, So these are biblically required in Truman Meiser. And that's based on the word degoncha. We have grapes. Now, there's a question whether biblically it applies to the grapes themselves or only as the Torah defines it, tiroshcha, which is wine. Which means if you have in the original state, if you have the grapes themselves, are they required, or is it only after the wine? And actually, when they separate Truma and Meiser, they actually wait for the wine. Because some hold that it doesn't actually apply to the grapes in the original form, it only applies to the processed grapes afterwards. And similar to that is also the olives, which is Yitzarecha, so that's a biblical commandment to take separations from these. However, the Rambam mentions it, is that we apply this to all Gidulei Karka, which means anything that grows in the ground, whether trees, whether vegetables, fruits, that's only rabbinic. That's only Drabanan that we apply to all other types of things. And the reasons we say Degoncha is anything that's anything which comes from the ground, we apply broadly to all different types of fruits and vegetables. Now, how do we go about doing this? So, we have to look at there's a cycle. The cycle starts like this. There's a seven each year is part of the cycle, a seven-year cycle. And that seventh-year cycle completes itself with Shemitah. We're now in the third year of the Shemitah cycle. Now, what happens is the first year, second year, fourth year, fifth year, you must take off the Truma, which goes to the Kohen. You must take off Maaser Rishon, that's what goes to the Levi, a tithe, which goes to the Levi. And then there's something called Maaser Sheni. That's another tenth, which is not given to anybody, but one takes it up to Yerushalayim, and he partakes of it in Yerushalayim. Or what he does is he redeems it onto a coin, he takes the coin up to Yerushalayim, he buys food there, and then he partakes of it, but it's restricted only within the confines of Yerushalayim. The third and sixth year, so the second tenth, what changes is, instead of taking that up to Yerushalayim, one has to distribute it to the poor. So that's what's called Maaser Ani, replaces the Maaser Sheni. And finally, the seventh year, Shemitah, there's nothing to separate because it's all Hefker. Now, one of the criteria for all the separations, requirement to separate, is if it belongs to somebody. It doesn't belong to anybody, and Shemitah doesn't belong to anybody, it's all Hefker, it's all ownerless, so then there's no requirement of Truma Maaser. Now, just on practical terms, what happens over here? You start off with the Truma Gedola. The recipient of Truma Gedola is the Kohen. How much do you give? Min HaTorah, any amount. You can take off a crumb. You can take off any amount. Your halacha, as far as your obligation, min HaTorah, you've fulfilled your obligation. But the Rabbanan did establish, and they said like this, if you're a cheapskate, so then you give 1 in 60, which is 1.67%. If you're an average person, you give 2%, 1 in 50. And if you're a generous person, you give 1 in 40, which is 2.5%. So that's the criteria that Chazal established, Midrabah. The next of what's given, that's given to the lady, that's my solution, that's 10%, right? Take that off, 10%. I mean, technically, it may be slightly less than 10% because you removed already the truma. So it's actually, but it's, for all intents and purposes, it's 10%. It doesn't change it that much. If we continue, this is not your obligation. What happens next is the Levi who received your Maaser Rishon, he must now turn around and give to the Kohen 10%. So from your original produce, that's 1%. Meaning, from your 10% you gave to him, he must now take off 10%. 10% of 10% is 1%. That's going to the, it's also going to the Kohen. He gets also from there. After that, we have the Maaser Sheni, which we say you consume, you don't give it away to anybody, but you must take it up to Yerushalayim. And that's because we've already taken off 10%, a little bit more than that. It's really 9%. It's 10% of the remainder, so that's about 9%. This is actually slightly less because, as we mentioned. And finally, not in the first, second, fourth, sixth, no, I'm sorry, first, second, fourth, fifth, but in the third and sixth, you would give to the Ani also 9%. Instead of taking to Yerushalayim, you give to the Ani that. Now, what does that mean? Everybody's interested in tax bracket, right? What does it mean? At the end of the day, what's my tax bracket? How much am I paying? So what that totals up is 2%, which goes to the Kohen, assuming you're an average person, 10%, which goes to the Levi, and that's it. In 4 years of the 7-year cycle, I'm done giving everything away. I have to make other separations, but I'm not giving to anybody. If, however, so that'd be 12%. So on the first, second, fourth, fifth years, you're giving a total of 12% away. You must take 9% up to your Shalom. That's what you get. That's not a bad tax bracket. You know, I know Trump is going to move that that direction, but it's not bad. However, in the third year, at the sixth year, so what happens is you're adding the Maaser Ani, that's the poor man's 9%. You're adding that to the equation, and that you have to give away, so you can't keep it for yourself. So then you come up with a total of 21%. It's also not bad. I mean, you know, it's not bad. Now, that's when they had a Beis Hamikdash, and we had all the trappings of living in Israel the way Jews would want to live in Israel. What happens today? How much do you really have to give away? So, Bizman HaZeh, what you're doing is like this. The Truma Gedola, as much as we said 1 2/3%, 2%, 2.5%, we only give a mashu. Why is that? We take the crumb. We take the smallest amount. Because nobody can use it. The Kohen can only consume Truma if he's taller. He has to eat it in a level of sanctity, which we don't have today. Since we don't have that level of sanctity, he can't use it anyway. It's gone to garbage. So there's no reason. Yes, rabbinically, we give more. That's when there's a recipient. But if there's no one to receive it, we're required. It's teva. We're forbidden to partake of it until we make the separations. But there's no reason to go and give a larger amount when you can give the small amount. As far as my Rishon is concerned, now here's an interesting thing. There are some, particularly by the Sfarim, who say, if you're, you know, actually have your farm, and you're actually, you know, certainty that this is not separated by anybody. You're taking straight off the fields. You're harvesting. They say you should give to a Levi. And there are many Sfardim who actually give 10%. They give it to somebody they can identify as a Levi. However, the Ashkenazim do not do this. We don't give anybody anything.
Why is that?
Why is that? So the reason is this.
Suffolk Levi.
Yeah, it's basically, there's an issue. I must, to for my obligation, I must separate it. But once I separate it, then there's already a monetary question. Do I keep it, or do I give it to you? So we say like this, Hamotzi Mechaveron Olav Harayim. You want my Meiser? Prove to me that you're a Levi. Okay, go prove to me that you're a Levi. You know, so since you can't prove it, so we say, essentially, you can keep it yourself. There's no Kedusha. Meiser Rishon doesn't have Kedusha. The Levi can use it. So there's no Kedusha. There's no restrictions on it. So there's no reason not to partake of it. It's a question. Should he benefit from it or should I benefit from it? So I say, I'll keep it for myself. Go prove otherwise. Trumas Meiser, that means from the Meiser Rishon, the 10%, which is 1% of the total, which goes to the coin, that's something that's Truma. Truma is the level of sanctity. You can't. So that you have no choice. You must separate that, and no one can use that because it has kedusha. It's truma. Truma has special kedusha. As far as Maaser Sheni is concerned, which is what you would take up to Yerushalayim. So normally you would either take the fruits themselves to Yerushalayim, or you would redeem them onto a coin, take the coin up to Yerushalayim. But we can't go to Yerushalayim because we can't eat it with sanctity anyway. So what we do is we do the pidyon, we do the redeeming onto a coin, and actually you don't even have to have equal value. You can redeem it even for not equal value, which means as long as you have a pruta is approximately 1.12, 1.3 cents today. So what you can do is you can redeem it, and that's it. And you'll end up destroying the coin, but then afterwards the fruits themselves are permitted. So you're not really giving anything to anybody, you're just doing a redemption. And my Maaser Ani, it also comes back to the same thing. You know, there is an Ani, there isn't an Ani, you know, who's an Ani, under what circumstances. So basically, we've become lenient about this as well, and people don't give up. There are some who do. I'm not saying there are people, you know, there are people who will take from the income generally. not just produce of Israel, but they'll take income and they give 10%. That's a beautiful minhag. Is it actually a requirement? You can discuss that with your rabbis. That's a question amongst the poskim. But when you tally up the total, what you're coming up with is really only slightly more than 1%. So it's not that difficult a mitzvah to know what's 1%. We waste so much to that. So a little bit more than 1%. And from the a farmer, 1% can be significant, but it's also, it's not the end of the world in terms of how much you actually have to separate. Now, how do you do this? Now, this is a lashon, it's based on the Chazon Ish, which is the most popular lashon which is used when someone makes the separation. So what do? You take your fruit, let's say you went to Costco, bought the clementines, and I would encourage it, there's no reason. Beautiful thing to be able to eat the fruits of Israel. But people are scared because, I don't know. And, what happens, what doesn't happen, and what happens also is that the Rabbanut, while basically, yes, of course, people, some want Mahadran Hashkacha, and some want regular Hashkacha, essentially all the produce of Israel is separated, except that which is designated for export. They don't take off anything. If it's grown and it's packaged for export purposes, nothing is removed. Now, why is that? It's for two reasons. It's number one, because there are some poskim that say that if something is designated for chutzlar, it's exempt. That's not the prevalent psak. That's not prevalent. However, there is such a psak. But also, the reality is that how much is actually coming to Jewish people in export? The fact is that fresh produce exported, which is, this discussion is mostly for fresh produce. It doesn't really relate so much to processed foods. Because processed foods, you're going to buy with a heksher. And if you're buying with a reliable heksher, all these issues have been resolved for you. But when you're buying fresh produce, so the reality is the U.S. is 6,000 miles away from Israel. Fresh produce has a short shelf life. They're going to ship it to countries like Russia. They're going to ship it to Western Europe. They're going to ship to even Japan sometimes, to other countries. Yeah. What? All of export, what I've been told by agricultural people in Israel is that from all the exported agriculture, about 9% comes to the U.S. And that's because, for example, people talk about flour. Israel has a tremendous flour export business. But flour is also a very short shelf life. So most of it's going to Europe. It's not coming to the U.S. Most of the Jaffa oranges are going to whatever's left of Jaffa. I mean, Jaffa is too urban today. All the orange groves have been, condominiums put up in the place. But essentially, it's about 9% that comes to the U.S. So, we're sort of on our own. Unless you know that it's coming with a heksher, it's our responsibility to address these issues. So essentially what happens is we take off a slightly more than 1%. We separate, the most common question is the clementines come in a little box or whatever. Take off one, or even less, the part of one, you cut it in half. You take off a little bit more than 1%, you separate it, and you just read this lashna. I can go through it, but I don't think we have to go all the details, but essentially what it declares is that small piece which I've separated is going to be the truma gedola, the mashahu of the truma gedola, and the trumas maaser. Because that's all I'm separating. It's a little bit more than 1%, and all the other separations will remain with my fruit. But what I need to do in addition to that is I need for my sushen, assuming I have fruit of the first, second, fourth, and fifth years, I'll need to be poda, I'll need to redeem them onto a coin, and we'll talk a little bit about the coin. And as far as the other separation, I separate them and then I use them. So I fulfilled my obligations. And then what I do is I have to wrap up the truma, to wrap it up, so I can't bring it to Bezayin. I can't wrap it up, and I can toss it, put it in a plastic bag. I can't sort of take something which has kedusha and defile it. So I try to at least put it in a way that it won't become mixed in with the rest of the garbage, and then I dispose of it. So that's essentially, it's not a very difficult process. The only concerns that come in are with the pidyon. Just anybody can take off the a little more than 1%. But the pidyon is actually interesting because you have to sort of know what you're doing over here. Let's say you take a nickel. A nickel has three prutas in it. If we say that a pruta is about 1.2%. It's based on silver. The cost of silver is actually not that high right now. I know people trying to sell you silver and gold and all kinds of precious metals, but I think silver is not that high. It was, 10 years ago, it was much higher than it is. So it's essentially, it's about 1.2, 1.3 cents. So you have in a nickel, you have three prutas. So if I buy fruit one time, so I do one pidyon onto that pruta, okay, I need to mark off on that nickel that I've done it one time. I do it a second time, and a second time, and I do it a third time, and it's a third time. That's it. I can't use that coin anymore. It's full. I've used it for pidyon. I've used all three prutas that are found in that nickel. I've used them for pidyon. So I can't redeem any more of it. Okay, so that's now there's another problem. When you're dealing with fruit, the 10%, which is the Maaser Sheni, itself is worth a pruta, right? Now, if the this is actually a technical halacha, but I'll mention it. If you're dealing, let's say you're sitting into a table to a meal, sometimes you have a spice. The amount that you're going to separate and leave on the side of the plate is so trivial, that 10% is not worth a pruta itself. I can't use a regular coin for that pidyon. The halacha is that only something which has a value of a pruta can I put onto a typical coin. If it's less than a pruta, you need to use a special coin called a pruta chamura. What is a pruta chamura? That is a pruta onto which someone had previously taken actual tevel and separated big poda onto it. Which means you have to go to a farmer in Israel who had real tevel. He took this, put it onto this coin. Once he did that, then I can already use the coin afterwards, subsequently. So what's popular in Israel is they have what's called Beis HaMaaser. That means different organizations that sort of, don't worry about it, we'll take care of everything. You subscribe to them, and they have all kinds of cheshbonos, how they do the pidyon. It's a whole complicated process. But essentially, once you subscribe to it, you can say, I'm separating my little more than 1%, and all the other things that whatever has to be poda, whether it's revai or whether it's the Maaser Sheni, it's all going onto the coin in the office over there on such and such street. They're taking care of it for me. Which is a great solution, right? Especially for us, we're so ignorant here in Chutz Laaretz, it's a great solution. But it's a problem. Why is it a problem? Because the Shulchan Aruch says that you need to use a coin which is an effective coin, tender, at this time and in this place. But we're in America. A shekel has no value here. You're talking a shekel going to the Costco. They'll laugh at you, right? And you can't use a shekel over here. So the fact that there's some office in Israel that made a Beis HaMaaser, so the OU is trying to resolve that. We're actually establishing a Beis HaMaaser here in Chutz Laaretz, which we're going to have a website with subscriptions. It's not 100% ready yet, so hopefully we'll be able to announce that soon. So this way it's based on dimes, on U.S. coins, so that you don't have to worry about the coins and how many times and all the other things. That's our problem. We'll resolve that for you, hopefully, and there'll be some kind of a public announcement once that happens. But meanwhile, what you can do is you can do the nickel or the dime or even a coin dollar or something like that. You can do it. You just have to keep track of how many times you did it to make sure that you have enough prutas within that. Now, what do you do with the coin afterwards? What happens is in the fourth year and in the sixth year, you need to, it's called Zman Habir, you have to get rid of all of the separations, which include the coin onto which I redeemed. So you have to deface the coin or you have to throw it into the water, into the ocean. So people go to the ocean, they toss it, and that's how you get rid of it. That's what the Shulchan Aruch says. I'm sorry?
Tashlich.
Yeah, it's a good time to do it, Tashlich. And finally, unless you do it on Rosh Hashanah, that'd be a problem.
Why can't you give it to the poor, right?
Because it has special kedusha on it. It has.
So it's not Maaser.
It's not Maaser. Maaser Ani, we don't do on the coin. Uh-huh. It's only Maaser Sheni, which has to be Yerushalayim in Betara, or it's the Revai, which is the fourth year if you planted a new tree. It's the fourth year. So it has special sanctity. It's really only it's a trivial amount of money, but we have to either deface it or we have to dispose of it into the water. Now, just on a practical level, if you're interested in Israeli agriculture, everyone compares Israel square mileage to the state of New Jersey, right? Similar square mileage. Actually, there's more arable land than is land which is fit for agriculture in New Jersey than there is in Israel. Because Israel has a lot of desert, right? Now, in terms of Israel agricultural output equals four times what New Jersey puts out. So Israel is an agricultural powerhouse. In spite of its, you know, climate issues and land issues, it's a, and there is export from Israel, a significant export. And most interesting, in the country itself, Israel provides for 95% of its own agricultural needs in the country. That means, you know, all the new fresh fruit, vegetables in Israel, you go to a store, 95% of the time you're buying local produce. That's just an interesting trivia as well. Now, we mentioned before that when something is designated to go to Chutz La'aretz, there is a Rambam which seems to indicate that if it's designated for Chutz La'aretz, then it's exempt. And that's what the Rabbanut sort of relies on by not taking off Truma Maaser from those designated for export. But the fact is that most of the Achronim, the Mishnah Malach, and many other Achronim either dispute the Rambam or dispute that the Rambam meant that. And the Rambam meant something else, and whatever, there's a whole discussion, we'll get into that. As far as what are those which are exported to the U.S., based on my contacts in Israel, these are the basically, you're not going to see all of them. I think it's important to note that this discussion is really for fresh. Because fresh, you can know, for example, Israeli dried parsley is a big export. But when you put dried parsley, it could be 10 years old, it could be 7 years old, it could be from Shemitah. So that, it's really hard to recommend because of the Shemitah issues, other issues that are present. But when you're dealing with fresh produce, the assumption is you're buying it now. It's which actually is an interesting thing, because Arla, if you have, usually when you plant new trees, you don't really get fruit from many trees until a couple of years. The third year is really the first opportunity. This year, you're going to have very little of that, because 3 years ago, Shemitah. So they weren't planting in Israel. For the most part, they weren't planting in Israel. So this year happens to be next year, might become once again an issue. So these are some of the fruit. I mean, you know what you see. Again, many fruits are identified. They're stickers. They're, you know, kind of crates or whatever they are. These are some of the things. As far as Arla is not really that big an issue. Orange is less than 0.5%. Grapefruit 0%. Clementines less than 0.5%. Which many feel when you're dealing with those tiny percentages, you don't really ignore it, because it's called a miut hamatsui versus miut ha'ishen hamatsui. A significant minority is something you need to be concerned with, but if it's so insignificant, we're dealing with such small percentages, you don't really need to be concerned. The ones apparently that are concerned is papaya and blueberries. I don't think you see much of those here. Maybe papaya you do see. But papaya is actually an interesting shiloh, because papaya is a whole question whether it's a fruit or whether it's a vegetable. You make hadam or you make a vertre eitz. Rabelski, Bashan from the OU, felt that it was a fruit, in spite of the fact you made hadam. You know, he said as far as the bracha is one thing, as far as arla is a different thing. So there's a dispute about that altogether. But the papaya and blueberries, I'm told, are those which have the, you know, they are planted. Most things today are little chashash, little concern for that. I'll just close with an interesting, this week's parsha, coming week's parsha, has the second parsha of Kriyat Shema. Last week we had the first parsha of Kriyat Shema, and this coming week is the second parsha of Kriyat Shema. And it says in the pasuk, it says, "V'samtem es dvarei ela al levavchem v'al nafshechem." So Rashi says an interesting thing. He says over there, quoting Chazal, that what do you mean "samtem es dvarei"? When you place the words, he says, even when you go into Golis, when you go into the exile, you should continue to do the mitzvahs, put on tefillin, make mezuzah. Why? So that when you return to Israel, they won't be new to you. So the Vilna Gaon asks the question. He says, the Gemara talks about, you know, mitzvahs. Mitzvah, which is, you know, relevant to the land of Israel. So you leave, you're going to Golis, so you won't have that mitzvah. So you have to, you know, somehow, we have to keep it in our memory so that we should know how to do that mitzvah when we come back to Israel. But tefillin, mezuzah, This is not dependent on the land. That's a mitzvah which we keep, you know, through the generations. So why are you talking about that? So the Vilna Gaon says something interesting. He says he believes that there was a Rashi. This Rashi was quoting that Rashi had the following Rashi Tevis. It said like this. That means an acronym. Rashi said, "Hey, tough, I am mem." So how did those who printed Rashi over again and they resolved the acronym for us? They said, "Hey, tough, hanichu tefillin, and I am mem." Asur mezuzas, right? He says that's what Rashi obviously meant. Why? Because the association, Kriya Shema talks about tefillin and mezuzah. So because of the association, the nearby association of the pasuk, it makes sense. That's what they said. Vilna Gaon says it's a mistake. He says that's not what Rashi meant. He says hey tof is hafrishu trumas, and ayin mem is asu maisras. He says that's what the pasuk is. And he said, because these are mitzvahs which are dependent on the land. So you go into chutzlars, you want. So in fact, the Rabbanan did expand the halacha of Trumas and Maisras, the Rabbanan, to other lands where you had a Jewish majority, which were lands where were from the original Olam Yitzrayim, where Yeshua conquered. Where we are, there's no mitzvah of Trumas and Maisras, but if we want to have some remembrance, we have some kind of a feeling for with anticipation of going back to Israel, and we will do these mitzvahs, Costco is providing us that opportunity. So I don't think it's something we should you know, delve into this and look into it further and try to do the mitzvah appropriately. It's a mitzvah. I think it's a beautiful thing to buy food from Israel. And we have an opportunity to do a mitzvah that hopefully we'll return to Israel and we'll do it every day of our lives. Thank you, Lauren, very much for listening. Appreciate it.
So bottom line, find something, Pastor, you bring it home. Do you need a special
fruit center? No. For that type of fruit, you can use a regular coin. Yeah. That's the bottom line. Again, I'm not going to tell you that. You know, that's typically especially like the clementines, right? Which is the most common. Carrots are that's packaged for chutzlars. Peppers, tomatoes. These are the things that Israel actually has done a lot of engineering to make these fruits with an extra long shelf life. So, meaning tomatoes, you know, are not that sturdy a vegetable. Israel has engineered tomatoes that have a very long shelf life. And they're unique, and they're desired. And that's why they bring them to the United States. So there are certain types of vegetables. But if you can, especially in these circumstances, you know, it's probably a good idea to speak to your rabbi and, you know, about the details. What?
I've asked many years.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're so ignorant, and I consider myself ignorant in this respect also. We're so removed from this. You know, we go to Israel, so we buy with the hechsher. You know, we're so removed from these concepts that unfortunately, times of Rabbanim, where even great Talmid Chachamim, they did this in a practical level. No, can't really give you advice.
You can rely on them doing it in Israel itself, because most of the farmers are not from Israel.
The problem is, no, in Israel, probably can rely.
Because,
the problem is what's designated for export, they don't have any separations.
They don't. They don't separate.
They don't separate.
So therefore you have to.
You have to.
Why can you rely on Israel when most of the farmers are?
Because everything in Israel is separate.
Even amongst the non-firm farmers?
There are other takes care of
this. Yes, again.
Again, I'm not going to tell you some distinctions in terms of, you know, there's a Mahadran, they want this, and that. These are distinctions. The reality is that in terms of our law, in terms of Trumas and Maisers, Rabbanut does separate.
And when you say poda, I mean the least amount of coin is a dime, or you can
need a penny is a problem, because a penny doesn't have a pruta in it.
Okay.
But if you have a nickel, a dime, you know, it's whatever, take a quarter, you can use it for a longer period of time, if you like Israeli clementines.
And when you poda, that's really masa on the masa sheni.
That's masa sheni, or if it's revai. On the question, maybe it's revai, which is, I think, a limited concern. It's basically masa sheni.
In how about Orla?
Well, if Orla would be forbidden, but the Revai, the fourth year is permitted, but you'd have to be pointed. Again, it's typically Maisa Shein. That's really
good. How do you know something is not Orla when it's coming out from Israel?
For the most part, the Orla is not that common.
Okay.
It's not that common. Especially, let's say, oranges, if that's what it is, or tomato. But it doesn't apply to, or it doesn't apply to vegetables. So tomatoes doesn't apply. It's only for fruits. So it's really
so
just
those the fruits in Israel, not orally coming to the United States? Is that what you're saying?
You can ride a rope. It's actually not a great rope. We're talking about 99%.
Okay.
That's not so. It's not that great a concern. But the real issue, I think, is separating the truma is important and disposing of it properly, and the ma'aser sheni. Many siddurim have this lashon of the chazon ish, which you can just say it, and just doing that pidgin and just keeping a coin. It can be done. So hopefully the OU gets this thing up. We'll have to get our act together. We'll have instructions. We'll have the details. Yeah.
Nothing about this is in any of the OU booklets. Every year they put out a something.
Yeah.
The same information over and
yeah.
Over again. Most of them, which is laughable.
Yeah.
Water.
Yeah.
But something
yeah.
Like this, they have
nothing. Yeah. There's actually a couple of articles. The OU did publish on this. There's a couple of articles. If you Google, you'll find it, or look at the OU's website. But I've been trying to do this for over a year now, to finalize this based on Meissen, so we can finally...
Can you get it to one of the sides, like, see that one on the chart?